Morning, everybody. So when I was praying this morning, I had no intention to add my manifest moment before I went to the trip, on the trip, or how I got on the trip. But as I was praying here, God kind of pushed me that I should share it again. Most of you have heard it, but there are some new faces that haven't and maybe forgot about it, but it was a pretty big deal. And I didn't even realize this morning was manifest moments, so then it kind of laughed after I realized that. But I collected stuff to have a yard sale as my first step into raising money for my trip. And the devil has a way of whispering in your ear, and he was whispering to me that I was kind of dumb or silly for even attempting that. How could I think that was going to bring me any money, or that I shouldn't do this, I shouldn't go on the trip? And I was listening. I was listening to say that, and I kind of got overwhelmed with my own feelings. I collected all the stuff in my garage, and I would go out there, and I was embarrassed, even though I collected this stuff for the sale, but I was embarrassed to see it. I was shutting myself off from people. I didn't want people to come help me because I was embarrassed about the piles of stuff I had, but the piles of stuff was a blessing because you all helped me gather that. And some of the ladies of the church could see me withdrawing, could see me building those walls up, and they wouldn't let me, and they came by without me saying yes to their text to come by, or they just showed up, and they went into that mess with me, and they helped me organize the stuff. But before they showed up, I was seriously just standing there overwhelmed, crying about how impossible a task it seemed. It seemed like it was as high as Mount Fuji. I didn't see a way to get the money for the trip. I was doubting if I should go. So I prayed in the mountains of stuff, and I asked God to just let me make $500 in my first sale that, like, for that weekend, and then I would know I was on the right path. Well, the ladies from the church came over, and as we were setting up, the neighbor across the street came over and said, "I won't be around tomorrow. Is there any way I can shop your sale today? My daughter is having a baby, and I would like to look at your stuff." And I said, "Sure." So while we were setting up, she bought $400 worth of my stuff. And I kind of laughed, but I was still thinking, well, I can't have a sale on Friday because I have to work, but I'll do it on Saturday. Well, then one of the girls said, "I can't be here very much, but can I run your sale for a little bit on Friday? That way you can have some people come." And I said, "Sure, I would take your help." Well, she ran the sale from 1 in the afternoon to like 4 o'clock, so that's a very small window to have a yard sale. And she made $500. And I was like, "Oh, okay." And so the next day I prayed with those girls again. I had the yard sale and I made $600. So if your math skills aren't good, that's $1,500 in one weekend. So God really showed up and showed off that weekend for me. As we were having that yard sale, my neighbor comes over and says, "Can you have a yard sale next weekend? Because I'm having a yard sale. And I think that would draw people in." And at that point, I was like, "No, I'm tired. I don't want to do that." But I agreed I would do that with her. The following weekend came. I didn't have my girls to help me set up. I didn't have my girls to help me run. I was not so excited about it. But I had gotten a $500 donation during that week, so I was up to like $2,000. And I was like, "Okay, well," I asked my middle son if he would pray with me over the yard sale, since I didn't have anybody else to pray with. And he was like, "Well, I'll stand here while you pray, but I am not praying." And I was like, "Oh, okay." So I prayed with him standing with me, and that day my yard sale raised another $1,500. And so that left me with $1,500 that I needed, $2,000 I needed left to be completely raised. But at that point, I had sold all my stuff. Like, I had some clothes, so I was like, okay. I was doubtful that I would raise any more money, much of anything, the next day. And but my son, seeing how I prayed and how God answered that. I didn't ask for a money amount from God. I just asked him to bless my sale and let me interact with the people. And I did interact with a lot of people, and I was able to share the gospel and what I was doing. And my brother-in-law, who is been hurt by the church, he was like, "Courtney, you need to stop telling people that this yard sale's for missions, because people will literally come in, hear you say that, and turn around and walk away." I said, "No, I can't hide the message of why I'm having this sale. I mean, this is part of the reason. I was able to connect with my neighbor who I hadn't been met before because she was chopping my yard sale yet again. So it comes to the Saturday, my last day of the sale. My friend said, you know, you only need $2,000. God could give that to you tomorrow. And I was like, sure. And that was bad on my part because I didn't have faith in that. And so the next day comes and I wake up to a $500 donation on my donation website, but I didn't say anything to anybody about it. And I get downstairs and my middle son looks at me, he goes, I'm praying for your sale today. And he was going to be leaving with my husband, so he was only going to get to be with me for a few minutes. And he comes up and he hugs me and he is praying and he's specific. He's like, God, give her the $1,500 she needs. I want to see it. I want her to raise that money and let her talk to people about Jesus. Well, 10 minutes later, when him and I were outside and I was hugging him goodbye, a person walks up to me in my yard sale and he gives me an envelope and says, this is for you. And I was like, okay. They left, so I opened the envelope with Owen, and I started crying because in that envelope was $1,500. Now, no one knew that price. No one knew that that's what I needed that day, except for Owen. And he got to see that God answered my prayer right there. He answered his prayer, and that's what he said. Mom, God heard me. God heard my prayer. So he provided for the whole trip, provided quickly for the whole trip. He provided beyond the amount I needed. People covered my money for my suitcases, for my gas, the food I ate. Like, it was a big blessing and confirmation that I needed to be there. And it grew my children's faith. It grew my relationships with people around me that I wasn't able to connect with before, but people like to come look at your junk, so it worked out very well. So that is a big manifest moment I'll probably carry with me the rest of my life, as will, I think, Owen. And it was important, I guess, to share again. I did want to take a few minutes this morning to thank you as a church. You gave me money. You gave me your time. You fed my family. You helped me with my yard sale. You gave donations to it. You helped serve along it. You helped clean it up. I used tables from the church. Like, you were just a solid rock with me through the whole thing. And most importantly, you guys prayed for me. And there were some times where I missed my family. I have never flown before, and it's a very long flight to Japan. And on the way there, I was like, oh. I had to pretend that I was in my husband's truck whenever the plane was pretty turbulent. I was like, there's a road beneath us. There's a road beneath us. It's not just air causing all these bumps. So I very much appreciate all you guys did. So we're going to start with watching a little video. Most of you have seen this video before. It was showed, like, I don't know, 2 months ago. But this film was done by the national office actually 3 days before I was in Japan. So I just feel like they're all my friends, and it's their message. And I just kind of want to give it to you so as like a refresher of what I experienced, but and get you on the same path as me as I go to talk this morning. So if you could play that video. Sometimes, I'm just speaking to the girls, and this is off cuff again, but sometimes the devil, because I'm a girl, says you can't do that. But Mabel Francis, 80 years ago, could do something for the Lord. Why can't I do something today? So don't ever let those hurdles stand. Don't let the devil stand in your way because you can do something. The main couple in that video were Don and Hazel. They are obviously coming off the field. It was bittersweet for them because we were the first team there for Envision, but we are there, Don and Hazel's last team, to come and see them before they leave the field. So whenever I met them, because I was a girl, I couldn't stay in the house with all the men, so I stayed in their home with them. And I couldn't have met more loving people in all of Japan, I don't think, or maybe even all the world. They were like instant grandparents, instant love, instant sunshine. So if you can pray for them as they are transitioning off the field and back here in America. Actually, they are both children of missionaries, so for them to be transitioning back to America is probably the first time in their actual lives that they're going to spend any real time in America, so they might need some extra prayer to live here in the States. Okay, so I just want to get this picture out of the way. It's a funny one. Everybody asks about Godzilla, so I'm going to start. If you're just here to listen to me, you see Godzilla. There's Courtney in front of the Godzilla. His eyes light up. He blows smoke out of his mouth, and that was really fun to see. So you guys know I went to Japan in February. I spent most of my time in Tokyo and then in Sendai. Japan is the fourth largest economy in the world, which actually Japan was the third largest economy until about 3 months ago, and they fell to the fourth. And a funny story was I was looking for a place to exchange my money for yen, and one of our Japanese friends was leading me all around trying to find a place, and we finally found a place, and she's like, it's there, and I'm like, oh, good, I'm going to go in. And I'm reading the sign to see how much the transfer factor is so I know what to expect, and all of a sudden she lets out a huge scream, and I'm like, oh, should I not go in there? Like, I thought like somebody was being stabbed or something. Like, the way she screamed, I was instantly terrified. And she was saddened at the amount of yen versus the American dollar, because they had fallen in the time that I was there, and their economy is shaking, and it's actually still kind of turbulent right now. And I just can't imagine any of us in America screaming about a transfer factor of money, not to the point where I thought someone was going to be murdered. And so it's a big thing in Japan. They're very focused on their finances and where they stand. So in Japan, it's the second largest unreached people group in the world. Only 2.6 of the population is Christian. Japan is classified as an unreached people group, meaning people, it's possible for them to live their whole life and never come in contact with a Christian. Just to give you a little glimpse of how big Tokyo is, I'd been to New York City, and I thought that was big. I didn't feel like Tokyo was big when I was standing on the ground, but they took me up into a building, and then when I looked around, this is like just one view out the window. There was seriously buildings as far as my eye could see. I'm like, okay, that's one side of the building. So then I go to the other side of the building. Okay, it's, again, buildings as far as I can see. And then I go to the other side of the building, and it's buildings as far as my eye could see. I could not get over, and no matter where I looked inside that building, there was buildings as far as my eye could see. It did not feel like that when you were standing in the middle of that city, but when you go up and look at it from above, you can totally feel it. In this picture, if you could see that little needle, that is a sky tree. That's the tallest tower in the world. And as you can tell, I was pretty tall. I was pretty high up there, pretty close to being as high as that was. I think I was at 47 floors high when I was looking out the window. So that's pretty crazy. According to the Japanese government, 69% of the population practices Shinto, which is the belief that non-living objects have spirits. There were people that I met that thought rice had spirits, and they would be insulted if you didn't eat all of the rice on your plate, because they felt like there was a spirit in that rice. 66.7% practice Buddhism. However, people tend to believe both, or could go either way, or they tend to believe nothing, but they follow the traditions that their parents did. So even though if they don't believe what they, what they're physically acting out, they do it to respect their family. We met an international worker. Oh, I just wanted to show you a picture of, like, this is a Buddhist temple, and another view of it. As we're walking around, so that's like huge. You can see it everywhere. And this is a shrine that one of the, like, they have like a central park, and this is one of their biggest shrines in Tokyo. One of the international workers we met, he was talking about a guy that he had been working with for 10 years. And the guy completely believed in God. He would come to the Bible studies, he'd come to church services, but he was not willing to give up visiting the shrine in order to follow Jesus, because he was not going to be the first person in 400 years of his family's history to not visit the shrine anymore. And that man is currently dying of cancer. So that's really hard on the missionaries, you know, that built this friendship, built this love in with this man. But he, the only thing that is keeping him back from Jesus is family tradition. So they are walking beside him as he's dying, knowing that he's not going to be met by Jesus because he doesn't want his family to stop visiting a shrine. Most Japanese men and women are willing to add Jesus to their agenda because, like, the Buddhists have many gods, so they just feel like they can add Jesus to their plate and not have to give up anything to have him in their life. They think Jesus alone, that's a too big of a task for him, and they don't want to bring him into their hearts as their only one because they want to have these other things going on. So that, to give you, the people that go to these temples, the temples are empty. You're not allowed to go take an actual picture up close, so this is as close as I could get to take a picture for you guys, but people bring themselves to go up to this empty building. Like, I was kind of excited. I'm like, I want to see what this is all about. So I walk up to the shrine, and I look in the window, and it's an empty room. I'm like, you guys are coming up here to say prayers to an empty room? Like, they'll buy things that are called talisman, so they'll pay money for these objects to set by these shrines. Sometimes they buy talismans, and there's spirit trees, which I have a picture of, and I'll show you. But they buy these little plaques, and they'll write their prayers on them, and they'll hang them on the trees. So, but it's all about money. You're buying these talismans to leave, or you're paying money to hang your prayer on your tree, but it's really an empty prayer to an empty building, and it's honestly like the saddest thing. They have these shrines everywhere. If you were really rich, you will have them in your, you can have them in your yard, but you'll see them on street corners, and they have like a series of gestures they do when they go up to them. It's bowing and clapping and then backing out, but it was just really sad to see them pay money. And it's like the more money you pay, the higher chance of your prayer being answered, I guess. But so that's like, here's a picture of one that we've seen on one of the islands. And there's a different one from a different island. They're just everywhere you could go, there are these little empty rooms. And here's a picture of one inside of a different area where they would, you take off your shoes, you could walk up and pray in front of these dolls. This is what a cemetery looks like in Japan. It is an empty little plot that people pay a lot of money for, and you get these sticks, and that's where you set them as you pray for your family member. This is a talisman that you could buy. We didn't know what they were, and that's when it was helpful to have someone with you, because my friend wanted to buy one as a souvenir, until they're like, oh, no, those are, you buy them, and then you leave them. And then the next day, they take them down and resell them for someone else to buy and leave. But that is their whole way of faith. This is the tree I was talking about. These are outside the big shrine I just showed you. People will come in, spend their money to buy this piece of wood, and they'll write their prayer on it and leave it up there, and that's their hope that that will be answered. This is the team I went with. Joy is in the front. She's the female. She went as our leader, and the rest are all lead students. I wanted to take a moment to also introduce you to all the missionaries that I met while I was in Japan. So this is Don, which you've seen in the video, him and Hazel. There's whose house I stayed in while we were in Tokyo for a short while. And like I said, they're coming off the field after 40 years, and they are also children of missionaries, which Dawn's parents were also missionaries in Japan, and they actually met Mabel Frances and were close friends with her when Dawn was a child. But they are who are in charge of supporting all the missionaries that are in Japan, so that will leave a big gap, I think, for the missionaries that are still going to be there when these elders leave the country. Someone else is going to have to step into that role. But who had as so much knowledge as they do, I'm not sure. But they are definitely a light for them while they're there. This is our envisioned family, the Nelsons. They are still in language study. Which in Japan you get a little longer for your language studies because the language is so very hard. But they have been in Japan now for almost two years. And their littlest daughter, Eleanor, is actually in actual Japanese school, which is very difficult. And the other two boys, they go to an international school. This is the Kropp family. They are in Ishinomaki. I butcher the names of the towns in Japan, but they are up north. They are church planners. And their family has been in Japan. Alan has been in Japan his whole life, except for he was born here in America. Their youngest son was actually born in Japan, but he is still not considered a local, even though he was born there. This is the Hai family. They are actually from Hong Kong, and then their families both grew and raised in New York City, and then they decided they were being called to Japan as missionaries. The female here, Venus, she was actually a lawyer, a high claims lawyer in New York City, and she said the hardest thing for her to be in Japan is she went from high status in New York City to lowest status possible in Japan. Like, people look at her as an outsider. They don't really want anything to do with her, and she's just there trying to love Jesus. She said to go from this high to this low was a big struggle. But it was really nice to see. She said it was nice for her to experience that because it humbled her a great deal. This is Quinn. She is a church planter, and she's actually pretty local. She has a lot of family right here in Greenville, Pennsylvania, which is where my family was from. So it was very nice meeting her in Japan. So this is the only picture I got of Jessica, and I'm very sorry, but you did see her in the video. Jessica's the blonde sitting at the table. She actually wasn't supposed to see us on our trip, but one of my partners there got sick, and so they had to leave and take him back, and we would be stranded in Tokyo by ourselves, which was scary enough. So Jessica came to transport us around, which we actually ended up having a great time. And this is Kevin. Kevin is not through the Alliance at all, but he's partnered with all the Alliance workers that we have over there, and he is the main pastor at the main church that our Alliance workers are at. So I felt the need to show you all Kevin. And this is Tomu and Kaori. These are the actual Japanese residents that have become pastors. They actually trained in New York City as well, then went back, but they just came to the United States just for their training. They run a Baptist church in Sendai, and it was very cool because we were just talking about where we're from, and I'm the only person from Pennsylvania, and they looked at me and they said, "Do you know where Kerwinsville is?" And I was like, I do know where Kerwinsville is. They said, "We have a supporting church in Kerwinsville, Pennsylvania," and how much support that church has given them. And I'm like, this is a random Baptist church in Japan, and they're supported by a little itty-bitty town in Pennsylvania. And that was just very cool to see God having his support there. So keep supporting people. It's supporting people you've never met. And that's what they said. They've never been to Pennsylvania. They've never been to the church in Kerwinsville, but somehow they got connected, and that church helped support them. Okay, now that's all the faces from Japan. Now I can actually start talking to you about what I was doing while I was there. One way we reach people in Japan, because as you can tell, they have everything, most people are willing to learn English. So they use ESL classes to connect with people. This is a picture of us, me and the missionary's children and one of my classmates. We are trying to get people to come talk to us on the street. We're trying to invite them to an event that we were having where we could sit down and have dinner and conversations in English. This, we prepared for this event for a day, and then we stood out in the streets for a day, and it decided to snow like 6 inches overnight for the day that we were gonna stand outside, so that was a very cold day. I've never been anywhere where I've seen oranges growing on the trees the day before and the next day have 6 inches of snow on the same tree. It was kind of mind-blowing. But we were on the streets, inviting people, talking to people. We got to meet a lot of people out on the street, mostly teenagers, but we did talk to a lot. We did attend a church service, and here's a photo of most of the people that attended the church service that day. The church that we attended and the church they use is actually just a little storefront, and they rent the storefront for like 2 hours every Sunday. Space is so unavailable in Tokyo and in Sendai even, that you can rent rooms for a couple hours, but not for like for a long distance of time. So they use this little storefront, which doesn't have heat or air conditioning. And they said in the summertime, because the windows are all there, they like dive heat. And then in the winter, they were pulling out little heaters that they all brought, trying to warm the room up, but most of the service was spent in our jackets. But this is the group that was attended church that day, and it was very good. I'll talk to you a little bit more about the church service in a few, but. And here's after the church service. They do something very cool at this church, because time and meeting there is so limited. They have a meal right after the service. Everybody packs their own lunch, and then they just sit down and fellowship. And I actually talked to Bruce, maybe in the fall I'd like to start this up here, because it was just so heartwarming. They really got to know each other and spend time just talking over a meal that no one was financially responsible for. You just bring it for yourself and celebrate each other. And there was a birthday that day, so there was a cake, and it was a very good time. Here are a few more pictures, of our street evangelism. We sang songs, had so many pictures taken of us. People didn't want to talk to us, but they sure did want to take our picture. We felt like celebrities. And we prayed over, this is right outside of a train station. And I can't say to you guys, like, train station, and you guys think like railroad tracks here. A train station there had four levels of train tracks. And then out the whole way around the train tracks were restaurants and stores. And so to me, it looked like a mall that happened to have four levels of train tracks through it. It was interesting. Everything that you could think of was in that building, like any store that we'd have here in New York City, they have there, and all their needs and wants are definitely taken care of. Here's the snow that I was talking to you about. In Japan, they do not have a snow plow service. If you have a building, you're in charge of taking care of the snow on your sidewalk and on the road. So to see people outside shoveling the road by hand was also very interesting, but it also left a lot of places still covered in snow because they work so many hours. I don't understand how they could possibly take care of the snow if you're at work all day and not home to take care of the snow. So there was lots of places there was lots of snow still on the roads for many days. So we talked about how we got to spend time pouring into the children. We did have a program where we got to meet and speak English to the children and play games with them. And here's just a little picture of Kiori, and she was getting out certificates because this was like, when we went, school ends in February, March, and then restarts in April. So she was giving out their last certificates about the things that they had accomplished. And here we're just playing silly games with the children. And even Duck, Duck, Goose was funny because they don't know the words that we do. They don't even have a lot of the same animals we do. So to teach them like cow and duck and make the sound and then have them play Duck, Duck, Goose was very fun. They put on a little program. All the men in my group practiced with the children for the program. So they got to spend time teaching them animals, teaching them animal noises. And then we got to hear and see what the animals did. And that's what they did with the children. Me as a woman, I actually decided to sit out with the moms as their children were in practicing, and I got to have conversations with all the moms. They spoke very little English, but I did have one of our native speakers there, so we could talk. And while we were sitting there, we exchanged treats. I had a bag of candy, they had little cookies that they had brought, and we were sharing them with each other. And the moms here, I wanted them to try a Reese cup. So I'm talking about the very little Reese cups that are wrapped in foil. I handed the Reese cup to this woman here that's sitting beside the man, the only man in the picture. I wanted her to try it, and she took this little Reese cup, you know, the size of a nickel. She unwrapped it, and she took the smallest bite I've ever seen in my life. Here in America, what would we have done? Pop that whole thing in our mouth. So she takes a little bite, and then she gives him the rest so he could take a little bite, and between the two of them, they still had half a Reese left. And I'm like, I don't even know how that's possible. But it was a clear reflection of their culture versus our culture. Here in America, we take big bites of everything we are exposed to, everything we do. We kind of like dive into it without thinking, without hesitation. Them there, like giving them Jesus, they're going to take a little teeny bite. They might not trust it. They're going to share it with their partner, take a little teeny bite, and still not really make much progress in it. Even after a couple bites, where we would just boop, pop it in our mouth and keep going and not even think if it's going to affect us or not. So that's this, it was this one thing that hit me as they were trying it. Another big part of my trip was to interact with the international workers, to love on them, to support them. This is me and Julie. We got the most time, I think, spent together. It was God, her manifest moment was she wanted to go to Japan, and she has narcolepsy. And her medication's not available in Japan, so they told her, no, you can't go. 2 weeks before, they were supposed to be settled, but they were being told, no, they can't go. God healed her from narcolepsy. So now she is able to serve in Japan and not have any side effects from her narcolepsy. And here's just a picture of us, again, having a meal, supporting and conversating with the international workers. And another one. Like, we spent a lot of time eating. I didn't put any pictures in because I didn't want to make Bruce jealous of all the beef I had in Japan. But I was going to share some vegetables, but I didn't. And yeah, oh look, guys, another picture of us eating. A lot of the time was spending time just gathering a better understanding of the culture of the Japanese. That was just a little alley that I just thought was pretty. And here's a picture of me. I always thought this cat was probably demonic, maybe because sometimes I think cats are a little demonic, but it turns out this cat is just saying hello. So I thought that was funny as a culture thing. I took that as evil just because I've seen it so many places, and it's just because I didn't understand. So I just want to encourage you to not judge something because you don't understand it. Here's a picture of like a street bar that you had to be 21 to go into, and they served a lot of food, and you could see it through the window. I thought this was a cool little dragon decoration on one of their buildings. In Japan, the culture is very family-oriented. They have multiple generations that live in one home. Parents and children sleep in the same bedroom most of the time because the houses are so small and they're trying to fit so many people into one area. They sleep on little futons, which is not a futon like you or I may have or in college. Their futons are just little flat mats that they sleep on the floor. Mothers in Japan are expected to stay home until their children are 3 years old. And once a child is three, then the child is then entered into the public school system. Fathers in Japan are expected to work 6 days a week. They work very long hours, at least 12-hour days. When I was, getting ahead of myself. So in Japan, you don't eat at home very often. You eat out. You eat alone when you're out. You don't even eat together. But this is a picture of a cupboard in Japan. This is just a little cupboard the size of a cooler that would be in their floor, and that's where you would store your food. And they shop every other day. The missionary said that was one of the biggest struggles because the crop family has, there's six of them. So to not have a place to store your food and to try to shop for six people every day would take up a lot of time. So they had to make some adjustments in their home, but I just thought this floor cupboard was pretty interesting to think that if you were a true Japanese, you would be shopping at least every other day, and this would be all the storage you would keep in your home for your food. This is a picture of my friend Brian. I laugh because I told you every corner has food because, like I said, they don't keep food in their homes. So you can buy a can of hot creamed corn to drink from the vending machine. And so this is just a picture of Brian drinking hot creamed corn, which I thought was very interesting, which would be something different in their culture than from here. And this is a vending machine with frozen food. You could just go down and pop your money in there and get your frozen meal to take home and eat by yourself. You cannot eat, and they don't want you to eat in public unless you're sitting preferably near your vending machine or near a table or a chair that's designated for you to eat. They don't want people walking around eating or drinking. So you have to go sit somewhere, and you have to take your garbage home with you. There are no garbage cans out in Japan. And I went to New York City, and there's trash everywhere, and it's disgustingly dirty. In Japan, in Tokyo, you could look for trash, but you're not going to find it, and you're not going to find a trash can. Every man and woman carries a bag with them. In the bag, they're going to have their trash. They're also going to have things that they can dry their hands on when they wash their hands in public. You won't normally find soap or anything to dry your hands on in the bathroom, so you bring those things with you. One thing that was surprising to me is how many men were sleeping on the trains. It's, like I said, the men work so many hours that they are falling asleep on these long commutes. They can barely stand up. They're working 6 days a week, and most, if you're a high businessman, you're then expected to go away on pleasure business trips with your boss on your one day off. So that doesn't even leave you any time to attend church if you wanted to. And that often breaks up their family units because the wives know that this is going on, and their wives are ashamed that it's going on, but their husband are businessmen, so you have to be proud of that and be accepting of that. One huge thing in Japan right now is it's common for people to feel isolated and alone, and suicide is far too common, including children. Japan has one of the highest suicide rates in the world. Middle-aged men are at high risk, but the focus in the media is on children and the elderly. Financial anxieties, bullying and isolation, and the lack of proficient mental health systems were factors in this high rate of suicide. The total number of suicides reported by schools in 2020 was about 411 suicides in students, compared to 368 the year before, and they just keep seeing a growing number. In the subways, which is a picture, I have these two bullet trains to show you, but in the subways, you can't see it in this picture, but they have installed blue lights all around, and the blue light is supposed to calm you down and then, I guess, make you feel better so you don't commit suicide. They actually play bird noises because there's not a lot of animals. Like, I didn't see any mice or chipmunks or really maybe like a handful of birds there, but not really any birds. So they play these bird noises to calm people down mentally while they're stressed out going from their job to their home. So when you step out in a subway in Japan, you always hear birds. And if you were there with me, I was doing this the whole time. Never once seen a bird. But the bird noises are so overwhelming that you feel like you should be seeing them. And now in Japan, they've put up barriers in a lot of the train stations to try to keep people off of the tracks. But now what they do is if you commit suicide by train, because it's so common, they're now charging families to clean up the mess or the damage that a body may have done. So insult to injury now. So that's how common suicide is, that they're now charging families for people that are jumping in front of trains. In Japan, their core value system is always doing what's best for the whole society. Doing your best, not giving up, and respecting your elders, knowing your role. You may never speak out against someone higher than you, even if you know they're wrong. So if you have a boss that's blatantly doing either the job wrong or doing something completely wrong, you will never speak against that. You just have to accept that and keep moving on with your life. Ruth Benedict describes the Japanese culture as a shame culture, contrasting it to the United States guilt culture. She wrote that Japanese were sensitive to the expectation and criticisms of others, with their social lives being closely tied to the idea of grace and obligation. In her views, were found of feelings of shame and focus on how one's moral conduct appeared to outsiders. We saw this firsthand while in Japan. For example, it is frowned upon to talk on buses or trains. Additionally, most people wore dark, muted colors, and those who did not were viewed negatively. One Japanese man summed it up this way. The nail that sticks out gets hammered. So here in the United States, if you're a squeaky wheel, you get oil. But in Japan, if you stood out, you're going to get hammered. When I was at Mount Fuji, I seen this picture on the wall, and that's origami. And it kind of reminded me of their culture. So here, these are all the little pieces of origami, but they use that origami to make this big picture. And if anything didn't fit, I think they would have thrown you away. But in here, it did turn out to be a beautiful picture. And I kind of laughed because in the Alliance Life magazine, if you guys got this and you want to know more about Japan, it's great to read. It's actually this current article, but they use the exact same picture I took in there, but they relate it completely different. They talked about how us as Christians work together to make a beautiful picture. But to me, it reminded me while I was there of the Japanese culture, because they have to fold themselves to fit the exact peg that they were made to be in, and if they don't, they're removed from the picture. But that's just one little takeaway from that. There's a multi-layered social structure when it comes to relating to the Japanese. You are heard if you are a leader of something or if you're the elder of your family. They will always listen to American Christians because they desire to know more about the American culture. Though this is more of a polite listening, and they will agree with everything you say, but it doesn't mean that they're going to change their heart. And since the Japanese often feel isolated and alone, they'll crave inclusion in relationships, but they are cautious about opening up. They share contact information through anonymous apps instead of phone numbers or emails. So we experienced that here in Japan. Whenever we were doing our street evangelism, we met thousands of people. We all talked to so many people. We handed out so many cards for our meeting, but then no one came. But the Japanese are so polite. If they're interested in you, they're going to come talk to you, and they're going to agree to everything you say, and you feel like you're getting somewhere, but you're really getting nowhere. They're just being nice to you. We do have some relationships that we made, but they are through apps that they'll talk to us that can hide their identity, so you can't expose them as talking to you. So there is an epidemic arising in Japan. It's called Fudoku, and Fudoku is when children find it difficult in school, so they drop out. This could be because of bullying, it could be because they are not academically excelling, and this starts as young as third grade. So in Japan, if you're in third grade and you are not succeeding in school, you can drop out. No one's going to say anything. No one's going to make you go. You can just be done. You can find a job. You're going to be the guy that's sweeping the dirt off the streets to keep it as perfectly clean as you can. It's so sad. And normally if that child falls into that at any point, then it's hard to ever get them acclimated back into the system. If you miss 1 year of school in Japan, it's almost impossible for you to pick back up. So Jill is one of the missionaries there. She has started a program where she's kind of introducing them to homeschooling to get the kids that may have dropped out to be able to work on their schooling and their skills to get them back into school before they fall too far behind. What happens often once someone is a Fudoku, or if you're an adult and you've already graduated because their school system's so rigid, there's another thing called hikikomori, I think is how you pronounce it, but it is described as an adult who will not leave their home. So if this happens, if you aren't excelling in life, or if something happens, or you're just overwhelmed and you become depressed, these mostly men will stop going outside. They will not leave their parents' home. They live in their parents' basement. And it's hard for them ever to enter into society again. So Jill's husband, Alan, he actually started he wasn't trying at all, but he just him being out and being present, people have come to him and said, I have my son or my nephew who won't come out of the house. Can you help him any way? And Alan has been using that as a way to go in and talk to these men. And he's been successful with some of the men and had them build relationships. And there's one man that he was able to make contact with that hadn't been out of the home in 5 years. And in this relationship he built, that man came out of his basement. He actually became a believer in Christ. He is now a missionary in Africa. So that was like, wow. Like, I kind of wish he was still in Japan, but Africa needs him too, as we all know. But what the people in Japan need is a non-judgmental listening ear. And I just had a couple pictures of just like, these are their cities. They don't lack anything. Here, if you think you need a friend, you can go out to a restaurant and have a dinner. It's not even necessary that you're going to talk to someone. In Japan, you can walk into a restaurant, order on an iPad, and this cat will bring you your food. And get mad at you, this cat will, if you're blocking its way and it can't get around your chair, just an FYI. But they absolutely need absolutely nothing. Look, go-karts on the street where you can dress up like any character you would like. This is their real life. See this billboard here, it's interactive. Like that cat climbs through the box and does all kinds of things. They are more advanced than we are. And they have no real needs. So they just need social and spiritual wholeness. And they're very much lacking that in Japan. We saw in Japan that you need to meet people where they are. This isn't like other countries where you can just set up in a park and have a service. We saw success in inviting people to our English group, even though they didn't come. Most of us do have relationships with someone we met on the streets that we're able to talk to through those apps. And I think the missionaries there could see success as we all build relationships with them and are able to share our faith with them, that they may eventually talk to the missionaries there. But the Japanese, they have they have much interest in the West. So, like, here's a picture of a teenager who would talk to us. And this girl could not speak one sentence in English or even hello, but she had such interest in me, she would just stand by me the whole time. And I think that it was completely due to her loneliness. She obviously just dressed for attention, because in Japan, like I said, everybody wears muted colors, and then all of a sudden you'll see a few very bright people. And I could see the loneliness in her eyes. Like, I couldn't get her to go away if I wanted to. Like, I didn't know how to tell her that. But she was just there, constant, lonely. And it was a sad thing. Most elderly were not open to conversation. Only the younger generation was. Normally the teens, 20s and 30s. They're looking for fulfillment. And they want to look outside their family traditions, which is a way that we can speak to them. There was no wedding rings in Japan. I didn't see any wedding rings, but I see some of the young ones are starting to wear them, which I think is just a grasp at the Western culture. Okay. I want to show you a person of peace. Everybody says how everywhere they go, they need a person of peace. And this is Miho. She, as you can see, she has sunshine in her eyes. She is a person of peace that they met there. I felt safer when she was around. She helped guide us through Japan. Alan described the mission work they do in Japan as a woodblock. Most people are common with seeing this photo. But how this photo was originally made is with wood blocks. So they would paint a piece of wood and press it down. And then you'd need another color, you paint it and press it down. And as you wouldn't know what it started out as, but this is what the picture ends as, and you have to wait through the whole process to get that picture. And that's what it's like preaching to people in Japan. You don't know how those relationships are going to start or what they're going to look like at the end, but this is what you're going for. In Japan, this is part of the church service. They did it all in Japanese and then gave us English printouts for the people there that did speak English but not fluent in Japan. And it was a very cool experience. If I was going to ask you to pray for anybody that I met in Japan, this would be Nobu. Nobu is not a Christian. Our first day there, we decided to go to McDonald's, which is rather funny. We had the church service. We didn't know where to pack our lunch, so we walked down to the McDonald's to grab McDonald's and then back. I didn't notice Nobu at the church service, and then I'm at McDonald's with my my classmate, and all of a sudden Nobu's like right here on me, and he's talking to me in English, like perfect English, which you don't hear over there. And he is asking about what I got and tell me how much he loves Dr. Pepper and how much he loves hamburgers. And Nobu has been coming around the missionaries there for a very long time. Before, he would only come to eat, but now he's attending the church services. We were at one of our last days there. We were at a dinner. We wanted to pray over the missionaries and leave. And Nobu came to that dinner. He was the only like guest there besides us. And he sat with us as we were praying. And at the end of the prayer, Nobu said amen. And that tells me, I think, that Nobu is opening his heart a little bit to what they're doing and what he's hearing, because when he first came around, he was totally against God, and he flat out said, I'm only here to speak English. I don't want anything to do with your God. But now he's involving himself in prayer and going to the church. So they're seeing him soften, and I think that's great. I just wanted to share this picture of the trains with you, because like the video said, this train was packed, and not a single believer's on that train except for the ones that were standing with us. And that was very heartbreaking to experience, to see that there could be that many people in that technology-advanced country and no one be a believer. I just wanted to tell you about being brave. I was so scared when I was there. Like, the missionary dropped us off in our hotel and left, so it was our job to feed ourselves and make ourselves comfortable and occupy ourselves until they come back for us. Well, there's so many things around us, but I don't know the language, I don't know the customs, and I don't want to ruin relationships or make a bad face for them. And so I actually called Nick and was like, I don't even know how to get to the store. And Nick's laughing at me because he's very directional, and he's like, Courtney, you just walk out and you go down the street. And I'm like, that's a far 5 minutes. And I was terrified to go, as you can see, this very short way. This is me successfully getting to the convenience store, guys. So I had to send it to Nick because I was happy about that. Whenever you use the bathroom there, I walked in, and what would you think when you walked into that bathroom? I was like, is this a boy's bathroom? Is this a girl's bathroom? Did I read the sign wrong? I walked back outside. Turns out it is a girl's bathroom. But that things are so different there. I didn't even know, this is this picture of the thermostat. I kind of laughed because our missionary friends have been there for 40 years, and then there's me there for 5 minutes. I'm using Google Translate for everything, even how to turn on the thermostat. And what God showed me there is that I am terrified. I was terrified of going to the store. I was terrified of doing anything. To put myself in that position when people come here that are not from here, I was thinking immigrants that may come to the United States, but in reality, even people that come here in the church, like somebody at the front door is terrified because they don't even know where the bathroom is. They don't know where they're even supposed to come into. So just be kind and treat people as you want to be treated. And God reminded me of that when I was over there, because I was the one out of place. I was the one not understanding anything. He showed me to be have grace and patience. Look, I was in the grocery store, and this is something I picked up. I don't know what it is. I didn't Google Translate it because I also didn't want to know what it was. Here, like on the streets, they'll sell fish on sticks, which sounds disgusting, but really wasn't that bad. And here's some pictures of the straw huts. And I just wanted to show you a couple pictures of what churches look like in Japan. Here is the Alliance Church that Dawn and Hazel run. On the outside, here's a random church that was down in the center of Tokyo. This is Tomu and Kiyori's church. This is a Baptist church. This is the only church that we actually seen, and one of the very few churches that would look like what you and I would call a church. And this is a church in a Shinonaki. That this church, when there was that tsunami in March 11th of 2011, Almost everything in that whole area was destroyed, but not the church. So it became like a landing point for the community to help heal that land around there. I wanted to remind you guys to be understanding of people that don't know English. And also, God reminds me of when I'm talking to people about God, I need to use language they understand. Like here is a sign in on Mount Fuji. If you see there in English, it says exit, but then they try to translate their words for us, and it says, please get out of here and go to the right. Like, oh, that's what exit means, okay. But when we are talking to people about God, we want to be mindful of what we're saying so they don't feel like you're telling them to please get out of here. Like, they need to be able to understand the words you're using and try to be mindful of what you're saying. I just put a couple other funny English words in there. Can't read that one here, but it says, serving one, please refrain from the smell. So serving one, please refrain from the smell. They don't want you to warm up anything. And here's a dish rack that said, it is the washing happily. I'm like, I've never, it is washing happily before. But everywhere we looked, there was bad English. I wanted to take a picture of this sign and show you because it said, make sure you know your gardener. Mind you, no one in Japan could probably read that picture, but to me it looks like the devil. And I want to know my gardener because I want him to be Jesus and I don't want him to be this devil-looking guy. And I just want to touch on their language. So this is a language that is used in Japan and China, and one of the missionaries were teaching us how God's in their language. I don't know what year this language came about, but this is the word righteous, which is the lamb is over beauty and self. So, like, that tells me whoever made this language based in Jesus' name. Here's Holy Bible, which is earth, mouth, and Lord. And that's all I'm going to really say for you guys today, other than I am graduating next month, and you all are invited to come if you choose. It is going to be at Grace Alliance, and that is July 27th at 6 p.m. If you have any questions or want to go, just let me know, and I can help talk you through that. And these are all the people that you'll see graduate. I just want to take a minute and pray for Japan before we go. And thank you guys for all listening. Dear Lord, thank you for allowing me this trip to Japan. Thank you for blessing the trip. But Lord, I ask you to keep toying on that soil over there. As the missionary said, it's a hard ground, but they can see the softness. They can see what's being stirred. And we're asking you to just continue your work there and raise up people here that are willing to go there. Lord, there are so many people there that can't hear unless people go and are willing to talk about you there. And there's such a need for it, Lord. Be with the workers there. Give them energy and help them withstand everything that's going on there and just keep them going. As when days are hard and they have an uphill battle, I just ask you to come along and support them all the way. In your name we pray. Amen. Thank you, guys. Have a great week.
Before everybody's released, I do just want to elaborate on what Courtney said there with her LEAD program. She's been in the LEAD program for 2 years, which is a rigorous program. Academically, it's very difficult. A lot of papers you have to write, a lot of theological stuff that she's had to go through. It's a long process, especially as a full-time worker and a mom and all the stuff. It's required a huge amount of sacrifice for her, and she is graduating. So we are going to celebrate her even outside of that. But I do want to encourage you, if you're able to make it, it is going to be a drive, but I know my family is going to make it. We're going to be there to celebrate all the work that she's put in over the last 2 years for that. And so that's July 27th. So just want to let you know that it is a big deal. She made it seem like it wasn't that big of a deal. It's a huge deal. It's a lot of work and a lot of commitment that she's put into that. So I just want to say thanks for what you shared this morning, Courtney, and I know we're proud of you and all that God has done through you. So